coming to you from the HagmanReport.com studio, located in the Keystone State, birthplace of a mighty nation. It's your host, Doug Hagman.
And welcome to Hagman. It's the Hagman Report, where truth can't be silenced despite the people trying to silence this platform. I'm referring to, well, my day-to-day, apparently, I guess. Nothing but attempts to try to silence this platform. I got a bill for legal expenses today. That's right. That's right. I'm talking about it. And, yeah, it's irritating when you've got to pay thousands of dollars for what I believe I just can't say any more than that, I guess. But I will. And the reason I bring this up is because there's a lot to get into today, obviously, from Iran, Iraq. I'm married. I'm kidding. Now, look, there's a lot to get into today. A lot of things happening all across the world, including here domestically. But the reason I started out with that, it was a deliberate mention, because I'm tired of playing defense. And I think Coach Dave Dobmeier had alluded to this many times before. We have to stop playing defense. Why are conservatives always playing defense? Why are we always playing defense? I want to know. Why aren't we playing offense? Because I can guarantee flipping to you, each and every one of you, I will be playing offense henceforth. That's right. You don't win playing defense. How many games of football have been won playing defense? I'm not a sports guy, okay? I know enough about football to be conversant. But the bottom line is you win on offense. You don't win on defense. So let's start playing defense, or let's start playing offense. So where does this leave us? I'm going to tell you. The first segment today, the first segment of the show today, I'm going to be talking about a very specific incident that happened 73 years ago. Or I'm sorry. Was it 73 years ago? Yeah, let's see. Let me do my math. 1946. You do the math. And perhaps we can use this as a template. I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to tell you I'm going to give you a historical account. So gather around. Grab your notepads. Or just your earbuds. I don't care. Before I get into it, of course, websites include HagmanReport.com. That's where you can find contributing articles. Kevin, check your email. If you haven't already, check your email. Other articles, my own thoughts. Show prep, important. The things that I believe are important. That's HagmanReport.com. HagmanReportLive.com, that's where you can find our videos and audios and such. Today's audio only, so don't adjust your YouTube screens or Roku sets or anything like that. All right. So it's audio right now only. I want to mention as well, Hagman Stores open, HagmanStore.com, HagmanStore.com. One more time, HagmanStore.com. Do you like good gourmet coffee? Oh, and do you like gourmet coffee that has a kick to it? That's Detective's Choice. But do you also like the fact that when you buy coffee, proceeds go to support boots-on-the-ground organizations that are helping victims of human and child trafficking and child sex slavery and trafficking? Yes, distinctly different issues. You can't clump everything together. Organizations like Vets for Child Rescue and Russ Dizdar's organization. That's where, so you're paying a little bit more. You're paying a premium for this gourmet coffee. But you're also, your money is also being used to fund operational boots on the ground, operations and expenses to cover the expenses. HagmanStore.com, that's HagmanStore.com. Three types of coffee, Detective's Choice, Revolution Blend, Patriot Blend, ground, whole bean, and K-Cups. HagmanStore.com. All right. sick of playing defense. Let's play some offense. But how, you know, have we ever done this before? At least domestically. Let's talk domestically first. Have we played offense before? Have American citizens, patriots, ever gotten sick and tired of being sick and tired and taking matters into their own hands and changed things, at least in recent history? Question mark, obviously. Yes. The answer is yes. I take you to the Battle of Athens, and I've talked about this before, but I want to talk about this in this segment as a standalone segment. Battle of Athens happened August 1st and 2nd, 1946. And I'm talking about Athens in McMinn County, Tennessee. It changed the course of history in that area. You can read about this in various locations, but there's not a lot of documentation. You won't find any many contemporaneous accounts of this, because even back then, the media was compromised. But this is important, and don't bother looking this up on Wikipedia, because you know why, right? I mean, do I have to tell you why? Here's what really happened on a hot August night, August 1st, 1946, known as the McMinn County War. This is right after World War II, when you had a number of returning U.S. veterans to the United States. Leaving Tennessee, of course, during World War II and in the run-up to World War II. Well, let me step back a little bit before that. Give you a little bit of important background. Just so people know, McMinn County, Tennessee, it exists between the cities of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Knoxville in the southern portion of Tennessee. You've got Athens, and which is the county seat, in Etowah. But as of 1940, the 1940 census, it had a population of roughly 31,000 people. All right. So, I mean, it's a small population. Now, you have to understand the background again, pre-1940, or at least pre Battle of Athens. When you look at the political landscape in McMinn County, Tennessee, you had, it was largely Republican. At least it voted Republican in 1932 and 1936. FDR, remember, was running on the presidential ticket. Well, FDR did not carry McMinn County in either 32 or 36. But something changed. He carried the county in 1940 and 1944. And the margins were extremely lopsided. Now, keep that in the back of your mind. The only other Democrats who carried McMinn County before and after that period of time, Woodrow Wilson in 1912 and Jimmy Carter in 1976. But the margins were close, or at least closer than they were when Democrats carried it in 40 and 44. So what's going on there? You've got to take a look at, do the numbers make sense? Did the numbers then make sense? So you got to take a look at that. All right. That's kind of like the background in terms of the voting particulars. Now, the elections that were lopsided on a county level, and even on a federal, even on a state and federal level, they were influenced by one family, at least one family, more, but one family, local family, the Cantrell, or Cantrell family, C-A-N-T-R-E-L-L, the Cantrell family. They were the political machinery of McMinn County, Tennessee, and specifically a guy by the name of Paul Cantrell back then, He built this Democratic Leviathan. Think Chicago-esque. All right. See, this Paul Cantrell of Etowah, Tennessee, and all of his wealthy relatives, funny how that is, Democrats preach, you know, anything but, or they don't want you to be wealthy, but nonetheless they are. They took advantage of the economic devastation from the Great Depression. They backed FDR. They backed the New Deal. Think New Green Deal today, if you want a template of how to play offense today. And they worked hard to replace the Republicans in county government, and they succeeded. Now think about what's happening today and what has happened over the last few decades. Inch by inch, we have ceded territory. We have ceded seats. Think back to the 2018 midterms. Oh, it was just midterms. You know, we gained Senate seats. Yes, but we lost House seats, which is given way to what? To what we're seeing right now, right? The impeachment fiasco and other such things gave us Ocasio-Cortez. It gave us Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. Really. So elections do have consequences, and especially elections that are fixed, that are rigged, as was McMinn County, Tennessee, back in 1946. Now, although this is about a voting situation, voting booths or voting machines or ballots, whatever you want to say, and ballots would be most appropriate, this template can be used, in my view, to any kind of offensive posture that we need to take today. So those who know about this, hey, bear with me. Those who don't know about this or don't know all about this or need to be reminded about this, I appreciate you listening. And share this off, or I'll make sure it's stands alone, and you can send it to people if you so desire. But here's the deal. I mentioned Paul Cantrell, the Cantrell family. Paul Cantrell became the sheriff of McMinn County back in 1936. And he won re-election in 38 and in 1940 as well. Now, his margin victories, or the margins of victory, were slim on those occasions. But then the sudden landslide victories of FDR in 1940 and 1944. Something changed here. Think about who counts the votes. Think about the political influence. Now, remember, we're fighting a war. The many men from McMinn County are out fighting a war overseas, World War II, during this period. Now, there's another guy's name, and the name of another guy you should know, Pat Mansfield. He ran for sheriff in 40 and 42, and won in those two elections. And Mansfield was a kind of a body double of Paul Cantrell, or at least an intellectual double. You know, the New Deal kind of thing. You get the idea, right? Now, back during this time, the Cantrell family and their allies, what they did was they cemented control over the county. In 1941, Cantrell and his operatives and a state representative by the name of George Woods, you know what they did? And think about how this applies today. They proposed an act to redistrict McMinn County. Oh, does that sound familiar? You can't win? Let's have some redistricting. And this was in the Tennessee legislature. It reduced voting precincts from 23 to 12, reduced justices of the peace from 14 to 7. It passed, and largely with the imprimatur and aid of former mayor, of course, E.H. Crump of Memphis, Tennessee. Now, his political machinery controlled most of Tennessee, including the governor's office, and one of Tennessee's U.S. senators. Again, I would urge you to apply that template, or what we see there, to what's going on today. So, Sheriff Cantrell, he benefited from the laws that that vested so much power in county sheriffs or two county sheriffs. Back then, the sheriff and his deputies, they would receive a fee for every arrest that they made. So, I mean, the incentive was there, kind of like the, you know, so-called parking ticket quota in a sense, but this with benefits, right? And here's the way it was back then. For example, the sheriffs in McMinn County under Cantrell, they would cross county or they would watch the, watch for cross county buses, for example. They would drag off people who were sleeping, charge them with public drunkenness, and fine them in order for them to be released. In fact, there were fines of $16.50 per person in order for them to be released. And the Cantrells, the sheriff's deputies and the sheriffs, they got a cut of that. There were also more lucrative, were the kickbacks that Cantrell and his deputies received from roadhouse owners. The deputies would let the roadhouses operate, but they would shake down less influential patrons. This is McMinn County, Tennessee, in the 40s. Now, the county seat, still under Republican control, ordered the county to purchase print-o-matic voting machines. There was a big suspicion that Paul Cantrell had won election in 1936 by swapping out these preloaded ballot boxes for the real ones. So in response to the order, Mr. Woods, who I mentioned earlier, introduced another bill to abolish the court. It too passed and the county sold the voting machines. But anyway, outraged citizens petitioned the federal government for oversight of the elections in 1940, in 1942, and 1944. Guess who they had petitioned the oversight to? Which department in the federal government? That's right, the Department of Justice. So the Department of Justice, United States Department of Justice back then, they jumped right on this. No, wait a minute. I'm sorry. That's fairy tale. No. They never replied. They turned a deaf ear. And again, I remind you, FDR carried McMinn County by with sudden landslides in 1940, 1944. So there was obviously a problem. Statistical anomalies, that doesn't cut it. In 1946, Cantrell and Mansfield, well, what they did was they decided to swap seats. They expected to control this election in 1946 as they controlled elections for 10 years. And I'm leading up to this battle now. So, I mean, it was a given. They were going to win. Well, now, what happened next? The GIs came back. Individuals, veterans, such as William White, Knox Henry, Walter Ellis, Jim Buttram, they returned to Athens. They came home and they looked around and they said, what the heck is going on around here? This is not the place we left. Think Billy Jack. Okay, anyway. Is that the one, folks? Anyway, you get my idea. They had their back pay from the army in their pockets. They were used to drinking beer on leave. So what did that make them? That made them targets of Pat Mansfield, who was sheriff at the time. Remember, Cantrell and Mansfield switched seats. Mansfield was a state rep and Cantrell was a sheriff, and now Mansfield was a sheriff and Cantrell was the state rep. But anyway, they were targets for the sheriff's deputies in McMinn County, specifically under Pat Mansfield's direction. You know, Mansfield, you talk about equal justice, or you talk about equal rights, or you know, about people of color. Well, guess what? Mansfield specifically, being the Democratic left socialist FDR supporter, green Green Deal supporter or New Deal supporter that he was, he treated the black veterans, worse than the whites. There was one account, and you won't find this in many places, where Mansfield and his men were gunning down black veterans just for sport. And obviously they were triggered by black veterans wearing uniforms. Now, the Battle of Athens didn't spark overnight. Beginning in early 1946, the veterans began meeting in secret. They decided to challenge the Cantrell-Mansfield machine at the ballot box. In May, they had their own political party, the Veterans Party. And I mentioned Knox Henry. Well, he ran for sheriff, and four other veterans ran for other county offices. Now, the Veterans Party had a simple but very specific slogan. Your vote will be counted as cast. In other words, yeah, we're not going to put up with this ballot box crap. And I mentioned this too in the context of Broward County, Florida, and Palm Beach County during the 2018 elections. You can go back and find the program that I talked about this in that context. But the context is, I'm done playing defense. I am all for offense, and I hope everyone is with me. How it will look, I don't know. I don't know. All right, let me continue. The campaign manager for the Veterans Party, Jim Buttram, what he did in order to make sure of fair and impartial elections, he sent two telegrams. Both actually on July 22nd, 1946, to then Governor Jim McCord, as well as U.S. Attorney General Tom Clark. And what this Veterans Party, it was a simple request. These two telegrams, it was very simple what he asked for. He said, look, we need your help. We're asking for your help to ensure a fair election. And both, they jumped right on this. No, neither recipient ever answered those telegrams. So as the election approached, they were on their own. Now, here's what the media did. The Veterans Party ran an ad in the July 30th issue of the Daily Post Athenian. And here's what this ad said. These young men fought and won a war for good government. They know what it takes and what it means to have a clean government. And they're energetic enough, honest enough, and intelligent enough to give us good, clean government. Now, the same issue of that newspaper, the Cantrell-Mansfield machine, ran this advertisement. You tell me what this says, or you tell me what this means. Look at the facts, and you will vote for the Democratic ticket. The campaign fight is as old as the hills. It is the story of the outs wanting back in. Wow. Okay. It was on July 30th of 1946 that sheriff's deputies in a neighboring county arrested two McMinn County deputies and confiscated a shipment of liquor. Now, these two deputies admitted at that time they were carrying election whiskey. What? For what? Well, for, you know, the post-election victory parties and such. Of course, the sheriff at the time, Mansfield, says, I didn't know anything about that. But anyway, the next day, there was one other significant happening the next day. On July 31st of 1946, the Veterans for Foreign Wars posted in neighboring Blount County, announced that they could send 450 veterans to McMinn County at need, if needed. This article appeared on the front page below the fold, and it was kind of out of sight, if you will. So this gave some people the idea that, hey, you know what, the McMinn Veterans Party, they weren't completely abandoned. The ad read this. It has come to my attention that certain elements intend to create a disturbance at or in and around the polls. In order to see that law and order is maintained, I will have several hundred deputies patrolling the county. Yeah. If you put things in perspective, the sheriff never, ever, ever had more than 15 deputies ever patrolling on election day at that time. So, day of election, August 1st, 1946, the polls opened at 9 a.m. The turnout was heavy. In fact, it was heavier than McMinn County ever saw. 200 deputies deployed to keep, were deployed to keep order. All right. Now, it's interesting because instead of keeping order, what these deputies did was they intimidated voters who they observed voting the wrong way. In other words, you vote for Veterans Party, the sheriff's deputies there were there to help you vote the right way for the Democrats. At about 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning, Walter Ellis, who was an election judge, protested the obvious intimidation. So what Sheriff Mansfield, what he did is deputies summarily arrested him and hauled him off to the county jail. So they stuck their own man, a guy by the name of Fred West, in as election judge. Dare not speak up. My goodness, you'll be tossed in jail. So, all right. I find this so interesting. Okay, let's move on here. Jim Buttram, he arranged about 200 GIs, 200 veterans. They were pounding on the door of a local jewelry store, L.L. Schaefer Jewelry Store, that he was using as an office. He had dire news for him already. He had no answer to his telegrams to Governor McCord in the U.S. Attorney General's office, Tom Clark. And at that point, a guy by the name of Otto Kennedy, who was a political advisor, said that Cantrell had posted armed guards, not sheriff's deputies, but armed guards, at every voting precinct, thus to throw the elections, obviously. So the veterans began calling up other veterans and fellow GIs of the same mindset to mobilize and arm themselves. And Kennedy offered the use of his garage and tire shop for him to be used as a meeting hall or a place to gather. It's about 3 o'clock in the afternoon on the 1st. The veterans who had called for mobilization had returned to that garage. They were all armed. All right. Here's where we get into some interesting happenings at, Tom Gillespie, who was a black farmer, he tried to vote at his usual precinct. Okay. Now, this was at the Athens Waterworks. A guy by the name of Windy Wise, who was one of Cantrell's guards, started calling him all sorts of racial slurs and said he was voting at the wrong precinct. And Tom Gillespie said, "Look, I've always voted here." So what Wise did in response to that was he struck him with brass knuckles. Gillespie, not wanting conflict, dropped his ballot, tried to leave. Windy Wise shot him in the back. That was the response. Can you hold that? Can we? Okay, I'm going to finish this. A crowd gathered in front of the waterworks, and Mansfield and several deputies loaded Gillespie into Mansfield's police cruiser and took him where? To the hospital? No, to jail. Now, inside the waterworks where this happened, the deputy Carl Neal, he drew his gun. He ordered five female poll watchers, including a woman by the name of Mrs. H.A. Vestal, to leave. Now, they did, but they did so under protest, and four veterans remained to watch the ongoing ballot count. James Edward Vestal, the wife of Mrs. Vestal, or I'm sorry, the son of Mrs. Vestal, Charles Scott, Charles Hyde, and Cartwright, Neil ordered Hyde and Cartwright to go up to the front of the store and sit down so they couldn't see the count. Well, again, these are poll watchers for the Veterans Party. And Hyde and Cartwright left the building. They're not going to have any of this, okay? No, this is not how we do things. Word was sent to the rest of the pole watchers to get out for your own safety. At about 3:15 or so, Minnis Wilburn, an officer of the election at Precinct 12, which was Precinct 12, the voting location was Dixie Cafe North White Street, beat GI election judge Bob Harrell. It happened after Harrell witnessed several voting irregularities. Well, we can't have that, so we're going to beat the hell out of this guy. He let everyone vote, minors. And some of these people were being paid in cash for their votes in view of everyone. The voting fraud was rampant. So this is a lawlessness like we see today. Pick a tyranny of your choice. Is it at the ballot box? Of course it is. Is it the Second Amendment, these out-of-control, tyrannical, rogue legislatures and governors making anti-constitutional laws? Absolutely. Is it at the abortion clinics or these infanticide mills who are killing unborn children and born children with impunity? Absolutely. Pick a tyranny. Pick a lawlessness area. In this case, it was voter fraud. And we have plenty of that today. And we've seen plenty of that. You're not going to write letters to the Department of Justice as they did in 1946 and expect to get anything. You're not going. So what happened here? I can go through incident after incident after incident throughout the day where the patience of the veterans was tested. Where there were ample signs of voting irregularities, voting outright voter fraud, complicity by elected and appointed officials. There were shootings, there were fights, there was voter intimidation. So the Veterans Party finally had enough of this junk. So sometime between 7:30 and 8:45, there were at least 500 veterans, all armed. They took up a station around the jail. On the rooftops of nearby buildings, including the Athens power plant. They left one door at the rear of the jail open, unguarded, so that those inside could escape with their lives if they so chose. And the reason they chose this location is because this is where everyone took the ballot boxes, which were to be counted in secret there, and, you know, if necessary, tweaked by the Cantrell machine, by the Democrats. So they took all the ballot boxes to this particular location, this jail, to count in secret, to fix as necessary, to make sure that the Democrat left party, FDR party, at that time won election. Well, inside that jail, Paul Cantrell, Pat Mansfield, Representative Woods, 50 deputies, what they did was they began going through the ballot boxes. And what did they find? Judge Green had an account which describes what the vets found later. There were a lot of blank ballots, various signs of preparation to burn ballots, just incredible voter irregularities, fraud, not right fraud. About 9 o'clock that night, Bill White issued an ultimatum. Give us the ballot boxes or we're coming after you. Well, here's the thing. The Mansfield Cantrell party said, no, thank you. No, we're going to do our thing here. Go pound sand. Now, it depends. At this point, it depends on which account you want to listen to and watch, because Hallmark Media did this movie, an American Story. All right. Maybe some of you saw that, an American Story. Well, there were, that was back in 1992. And, this was a fictionalized account of the Battle of Athens. However, that movie changed a lot of key details and put the violence, the onus of violence on the veterans. In fact, They changed key details of the election and the battles that followed. And the battle that followed, one, the shooting that reportedly occurred initially occurred at a post office precinct. The sheriff closes the polls early. An armed GI reportedly, election judge reportedly objected, and the deputy calmly shoots the veteran in the right flank. The deputies then removed two ballot boxes from that precinct. All right. A lot of this was changed. The chief veteran challenger was running for mayor, not sheriff. The first shot at the jail rang out when the deputy leaned out of a window and just started harassing the individuals, the crowd and such. And one of the individuals shot, breaks discipline, fires a shot without orders. It was a fictionalized account that really did not do well for the, or did not do the veterans any favors, the right, the people in the right any favors. I'm just saying. So even in the fictional account, as stated in that movie, in that Hallmark movie, folks, you have to understand the American story is a fictional account that changes some specific issues, in my view anyway. And this is also substantiated in various other reports elsewhere. But here's the bottom line. The leftists in the jailhouse had the ballot boxes. The veterans outside said, look, we're going to give you a few minutes. You bring the ballot boxes out, no one's going to get hurt. And let's count them out in the open how it should be. No, thank you. Well, oh, and by the way, during this time, Mansfield and Cantrell, remember the Democratic leftists, what they did, they made frantic calls to Governor McCord at the time. Look, we need to mobilize the Tennessee National Guard. We have an uprising here. American veterans, they're armed. In fact, they got their weapons from the armory. We have to put this uprising down. We have to call the National Guard. National Guard never responded. Perhaps because the majority of National Guardsmen were veterans themselves. Think about how that would apply today. Long and the short of it is this. There was a battle. There was shots fired back and forth. The veterans did obtain dynamite, some dynamite charges. The bottom line is we won. They won. Just about quarter to 3 a.m. on August 2nd, the veterans, the people who were for having the ballots counted out in the open, tossed their dynamite that they got along with their arms and lit the fuses. One charged, the explosions happened. Subsequent to that and the fact that the people inside that jail were faced with overwhelming force from the people who wanted open and free elections. They abandoned the jailhouse, left the boxes. They left their boxes. And the boxes showed an overwhelming victory for the veterans. Both by ballot box and by morale. And of course, even back then, you had fake news. The New York Times reported that the veterans, or at least those sympathetic to the veterans, had slain Sheriff Mansfield. The battle, however, that I referenced concluded without a single fatality. So, it was a fake narrative, fake news narrative of lawlessness by the veterans. And that was pounded home by the press for a full year afterwards. But you know what? No veteran was ever prosecuted. Oh, and remember Wendy Wise, who shot the black man, Gillespie, in the back? He was sentenced to 1 to 3 years for shooting Gillespie. Bottom line is, we won. But we didn't win by playing defense, by writing letters, by making phone calls, and by saying please. We won. They won because they had the guts and determination to say, you know what? Not now, not here, and certainly not in our lifetime. You ain't doing this. So I don't know if that, I don't know if that story has any meaning today, but I would urge everyone to look up the Battle of McMinn, Battle of Athens, the McMinn County War, and tell me what you think. Do we need another McMinn County War? I think we do. You're listening to the Hagmann Report. It's the Hagmann Report where truth can't be silenced. Again, websites to the truth include HagmannReport.com, HagmannReportLive.com. The latter, of course, is where you'll find our video, audio, downloads, and everything else. All right. Thank you for bearing with me on that. And thank you, Keith, for allowing me to run over on that. Keith, how are you, brother?
I'm good. For a moment, I kind of forgot that I was waiting to come on with you. I kind of felt like I was listening to a podcast of, you know, like Crime Junkies or something like that. That was well done. I think you should, in addition to doing talk radio, I think you should narrate some of these true crime podcasts that are out there. It was actually very soothing. I was getting some work done here and listening to you and just thinking, wow, I'm in this Zen mood right now. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for that. Your check will be in the mail for you. I appreciate that. But you know what? Seriously, I opened the program up, in not a very fancy mood, not a very good mood because, you know, I'm tired of playing defense. It seems like everything that we do, we're playing defense every single day of our lives as conservatives, as Christians, as people with morals and values. What, we have to defend our morals while the left, Luciferian elite, whatever you want to call them, morons, shove their immorality down our throats and say we have to accept it? I don't think so. So, you know what? What do we use as a template to, what can we use as a template? And when I was searching for, you know, was there anything in history, recent history, that shows us somebody fought back? I found this. I found the Battle of Athens. We fought back and we won. So I'm not saying take up arms and dynamite against your, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying, hey, it worked then. Anyway, so I'm just tired of playing defense.
Well, reflecting on the conversation that you and I had yesterday and then, of course, thinking about what happened last night, I was actually on my way. I like to work out in my local gym pretty late at night because there's nobody there. I can go in and I pretty much have my run on the place. So I was heading out to the gym at about 8 o'clock last night, and that's when the reports started coming in of the rocket attacks against the bases in Iraq, courtesy of Iran. And you know, my initial reaction was, yep, okay, here we go. This is it. And then, you know, the more that I thought about it, the more that I thought that, you know, in the words of Michael Friedson, the editor of the Media Line, who's been on your show and my show in the past, sure. Yeah. Every time there is an act of aggression by the Iranian regime, I think a lot of people look at it and go, oh, okay, this is it. This is going to be the spark. This is what's going to set this whole thing off. And it never, ever does. And exactly as we saw this morning, the president is now talking about additional sanctions. I mean, the hardest sanctions possible against Iran. So, you know, as I'm listening to you talking about the McMinn County War, and I'm thinking about what happened in Iraq, and I'm thinking about what's going on right now in Virginia. And then you're talking about, you know, when is the last time somebody fought back? And I have to go back to a story of the 2 years when I was in middle school from sixth grade into seventh grade and into the start of my eighth grade year, where I had a bully. And I'm sure many of your listeners had a bully. For whatever reason, this particular kid just decided that I was the person who, by making my life hell, he was going to somehow compensate for whatever shortcoming he had in his own life. And for 2 years, I ran, I hid, I looked over my shoulder, I bought bags of gummy bears and handed over lunch money in an attempt to appease this kid. And then finally, it was a Monday night. I'm sure most people who grew up as Catholics or Christians had Sunday school. Well, we had our middle school had Sunday school on Monday nights. And so the church hall was basically about three blocks away from my house. So I was leaving the church hall from the Sunday school that was held on Monday night, and this kid jumped on my back. And he actually had jumped on my back from an elevated position from three steps up. And something inside of me just snapped. And I just said, you know what? I have had enough. Now, I was facing a crucial decision at that point. Okay. I could try to break free and I could run away, or I could stand my ground. And in doing so, I ran the risk of possibly getting hurt. I mean, listen, I could get beat up by this kid. Okay. But I made the decision to stand up for myself. And when he jumped on my back, I managed to roll him off. And as he rolled off, I just hauled off and I clenched my fist and I reached somewhere into the neighboring state. And when that fist came forward and made contact with his face, there was 2 years worth of, I have had enough of this, that was powering it.
Wow.
To make a long story short, everything that was bothering me in my life at that particular point in time ended the moment my fist made contact with his mouth. Yep. Unfortunately, he had braces, so it took several stitches to close up the gashes inside of his mouth. He wasn't in school the next day or the next day after. I can tell you the Thursday that he returned back to school, when he saw me in the hallway, he did an about face and ducked into the closest classroom. And from that point forward, he avoided me because he knew at that point it was never going to happen again. And so one of the things that I've said many times on my media and on your media, I said this yesterday, as a matter of fact, criminals, bullies, thugs, and tyrants. Now, that could be the Ayatollah Khomeini, or that could be the governor and the executive leadership and the lawmakers in the state of Virginia, or it could be your seventh grade bully.
You go.
They all fit into the same category.
Yep.
But they only respect and understand one thing, and that is force. Force that is equal to or greater than the force they themselves are capable of expending. That's all that they respect. And if you want to segment this and look at it from the Iran standpoint, Iran doesn't give a rat's ass about our sanctions, because for them, this is a much higher calling. You have to remember that Iran is an Islamic state, the Islamic state of Iran.
Correct.
This is a religious ideology that is governing this. Now, you ask, here's the perfect example. You ask Christians to stand their ground, or if you ask a Christian to do something that violates the tenets of their faith, okay, well, that's going to be a true test about whether or not a person is a fair-weather Christian or a person is truly devoted. They've truly given their lives and their hearts over to Christ.
Well, I'm not sure. I just want to take issue with that. Violates the tenets of their faith. I don't think standing up for oneself or having righteous anger, righteous actions that include righteous anger is a violation of the tenets of one's Christian faith. That's just my view. But go on.
No, and that's not the point. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is, I'm using this as an example.
Okay, all right.
You take a person who claims to be a Christian and ask them to do something that violates their faith. Now, the fair weather Christians are going to turn around and say, no, you know, they're going to turn around and say, okay, sure, no problem. They can somehow, some way in their twisted morality or whatever guides them, they can find justification as to why they can violate God's law. Okay. And they could violate their own morals and ethics. But a person who has truly given their hearts and their lives over to Christ, they are not about to do anything that violates the tenets of the faith.
True.
They are going to do it steadfastly. Listen, you can do what you want to do. I mean, look at the instances where people in active shooter situations, I believe it was in Columbine, where one of the girls that was executed was asked, are you a Christian? And she said yes, and was subsequently shot in the head. There are people who have taken Christ to their death.
Yes.
Okay, that is a person who will not betray their faith. Okay, well, think about this. Being executed is the ultimate sanction that a bully or a criminal or a thug or a tyrant could possibly put against you. Yet in the face of the most extreme sanction, you maintain your faith steadfastly. So I would ask you, the fundamentalist Islamic State of Iraq, is there a sanction that we could possibly put against them that's going to violate the tenets of their faith or cause them to now somehow turn their backs on the government, which has been established via the tenets of radical Islam? That's the question that I'm asking you. They don't care about our sanctions. There's only one thing that Iran understands or that would change the course of action with Iran, and that is eliminating them. Turning them into a glowing slag heap, a veritable parking lot in the Middle East. And I was reading some of the comments yesterday on yesterday's show, and there's a lot of people that do not understand the basics of the power balance and what has happened in the Middle East to understand why Iran has become such a rogue regime.
And please explain this, because I saw the same thing. And it's necessary for people to have that basic understanding in order to understand how we got here and what we're going to do about it, or what we should do about it. Go ahead.
Well, in essence, I mean, to simplify this, we could turn this into a three-hour show, but I'm going to simplify this. It is the reestablishment of a caliphate, the reestablishment of a nation or a landmass that is governed by religious morality and religious doctrine. I mean, really, the last time that we saw a caliphate was the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was in essence dismantled courtesy of the West in an attempt to preserve trade routes through the Middle East from India and from the Orient. And so what happened was the Ottoman Empire was broken up. And so you had all these different nations that were established, because the concept that has been rooted in Arab culture for thousands of years, the shame honor tradition, determines and dictates that these Bedouinic tribes are going to be, they have been warring against each other for millennia and will continue to war against each other for millennia. It is all about power. It is all about control. And it is all about which particular sect or faction of radical Islam you happen to be a part of, and which of those sects or which of those factions is ultimately going to wind up establishing the Islamic State and having ultimate control of the Islamic State. And there's, I mean, this ties into what's going on with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia as well. That's a different story. But the ongoing feud has to do with ultimately who will control the Muslim Holy Land. Now, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is a hereditary monarchy. The hereditary monarchy is in stark violation of the Sunnah. And so Iran does not recognize the validity of the hereditary monarchy that exists within the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which is one of the biggest reasons why they want to see the House of Saud fall. Now, that's right. Again, that's a different story. But ultimately, what this boils down to is a religious fight. This is a religious battle. And so you are no sooner going to get Iran to change the course of their action via sanctions than you are to get a person who is deeply, and I mean devoutly Christian, who has given their hearts and their lives over to Christ, to get them to change their behavior or to behave in a manner that violates the tenets of their faith with even the most extreme of sanctions.
Very well said. Yes, yes. So it's a religious tribal war that's existed for centuries. And we're not going to change it, obviously. In part, that is. And by the way, this didn't happen overnight in terms of this mess in the Middle East. more of more recent times, and I really believe that we have to look at this engineered Arab Spring under the Obama regime and engineered by the Obama regime and the cohorts, you know, within the Western intelligence and the players in the Middle East too, because Arab Spring was, in my view, designated to swap the balance of power. In the
well, the Arab Spring, the media, which, I mean, the American drive-by left-wing media is a great propaganda arm for everything that is bad about the Middle East. The Arab Spring, you know, this was just a group of young people who are trying to establish democracy and all of these wonderful tenets. No, the Arab Spring was the uprising of what would eventually give way to the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or is ISIL, you know, ISIL, which is what it's officially known as, or ISIS, what it's been colloquially and commonly known as. But even when you look at that, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, what is the Levant? Well, the Levant is the landmass that's on the western border of the Mediterranean Sea. It is a caliphate, and the whole purpose of ISIS was to undo. As a matter of fact, when ISIS used to put out their propaganda videos, one of the propaganda videos that first came out, and there was a theme of these videos, was the dismantling of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And the Sykes-Picot Agreement was the accord by which the Ottoman Empire, the last true caliphate, was actually dismantled. And these splinter countries were then established, and control of those splinter countries were handed over to certain leaders of certain Bedouinic tribes. And as you and I were talking 2 hours ago off air, there is a balance of power there. You know, you said that the Middle East kind of fell when the statue of Saddam Hussein was torn down in the square. And I remember where I was the day that that happened. And I remember watching that. And, you know, to a certain degree, you're correct on that. Because as horrible of a dictator, as murderous of a tyrant as Saddam Hussein was, there was a certain level of balance that was brought via an Iraq that was controlled by Saddam Hussein, a Libya that was controlled by Muammar Gaddafi, and the rest of the nations that make up the Middle East. That's it was right. A power balance. And you know as well as I do, as well as your listeners do, that the moment that you abruptly withdraw something from an equation, you create a vacuum. Something eventually will fill that vacuum. So there has to be a cost-benefit analysis. What is the harm in leaving us? Where it's, you know, from a legal, you're a legal wonk just like I am. It's the doctrine of competing harms. Which is worse, leaving a murderous dictator, a heinous tyrant in power, or taking that person out and now permitting something that could potentially be far worse from filling the void that was created by the elimination of that tyrant?
The devil you know versus the devil you don't and the chaos it creates. Yeah, I
totally. Well put.
Yeah.
One of the things I would recommend to your listeners, if you guys can get a copy of this book, read it, because it is a fascinating, fascinating look at the history of the culture of Arab nations and these Arab Bedouinic tribes. It's a book called The Closed Circle, An Interpretation of the Arabs, and it's authored by a gentleman named David Price Jones. I had him on my show. Talk about a hard guy to get a hold of. He lives on an island off the coast of Wales. I mean, this guy lives about as far off the grid as you can possibly go. So getting him on the show was pretty – I had to wait until he was actually traveling over to the mainland and had internet access. So that way there – I mean, we were actually corresponding via snail mail. It was pretty crazy.
Oh, it's my dream.
Yeah, it's like back in the days when you would get a pen pal and you'd write a letter and put a stamp on it and drop it in a mailbox and forget about it. And 6 months later, you'd get a response from somebody halfway around the world. But The Closed Circle, An Interpretation of the Arabs by David Price Jones. And there's many, many copies of it. You can pick up used copies, $3 or $4 on Amazon. But if you're really interested in understanding some of the basic concepts of the Arab culture, not the Islamic culture, but the Arab culture, read this book, because what it will do is give you a lot of background information and a factual foundation which will help you to understand how and why people behave the way that they do over there. But I'll give you a little bit of a teaser with this. The shame honor tradition is something that has existed for millennia, and it's deeply embedded in their culture, in the Arab culture, the shame honor tradition. You either shame your family, and when I'm talking about family, I'm not talking about, you know, the Hagmans, son, father, daughter, uncle. We're talking about, you know, the basically these Bedouinic tribes, your tribe. You either bring shame to your tribe or you bring honor to your tribe. But this is the reason, the shame honor tradition is the reason why so many of these groups, so many of these Arab cultures or groups that stem from Arab cultures are locked in this never ending battle of I got you last. It's like the Crips and the Bloods. Oh, I gotta retaliate against you for what you did. Oh, I gotta retaliate against you for what you did in retaliation for what I did in retaliation for what you did in retaliation for what I did. And this just goes on and on and on. It's a beltway you can't get off of.
Very true. Very true. Yeah. Okay. So where we find ourselves today, I believe, in my view, I mean, people will go back and say, well, it's 1979, that really, kicked things off, you know, February 79 when, Khomeini came back from France. And then of course in November, what happened with our embassies, embassy, the 52 hostages, 444 days, and some will go back to 53, in terms of what we did to overthrow the elected government in Iran. But I would say, look, if you want to go with something more recent, and again, just to mention that to rehash what we said, I would go back to 2003 at that moment that statue was toppled. What that did was that gave Iran the upper hand. It allowed them to infiltrate Iraq as they are today, as they have today. You've got the majority of Iranians, the majority of Shia in Iraq, and these are the ones that are causing the trouble. These are the groups that are causing the trouble in Iraq, in Iraq right now. And you know, it doesn't take a lot of money to craft some IEDs. And by the way, all of these IEDs that we're seeing, complements of proxies of Iran.
I'd like to know how many of those missiles were purchased or bought and paid for by the $1.8 billion that were shipped off. You know, what Obama has done in the past and previous presidents have done in the past is no different than what I did when I went down to Woodbine's country store and bought bags of gummy bears, hoping that if I gave my bully a bag of gummy bears, he'd leave me alone for the day. If I made him happy with a bag of gummy bears or my 65 cents in lunch money, 65 cents for a school lunch back when I was a kid, by the way.
Yeah.
Then I would buy myself one day of peace. That was one day that I didn't have to worry about getting stuffed in a locker, you know, or getting punched in the back of the head or whatever the case may be. That's nothing more than appeasement. But again, appeasement does nothing more than reinforce that whatever negative behavior I'm engaging in is exactly what I need to do to get my basic needs met.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But by the way,
what is actually going to break the cycle is an unquestionable use and show of force. Because again, that's the only thing that these people respect and understand.
Exactly.
And you know, for these people that, you know, I'm reading a comment here, from one of your listeners on yesterday's show, Iran has just attacked a U.S. base in Iraq. Thank you, America, for starting another war, which will get your innocent people killed, blah, 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 blah. What I would suggest to the person that wrote that is actually put down your opinion and study the facts of the Middle East. Maybe, and I don't know, maybe it doesn't come as a, maybe this is news to this person, but Iran has been in a de facto state of war against the United States of America and the U.S. allies since at least 1979.
Correct.
I was in nursery school when the Iran hostage scandal came out. And think about this, by the way. What was it that ultimately got those hostages released? Was it slick sanctions? Was it the amazing diplomacy of President Jimmy Carter and his crack squad of diplomats? No, it was the fear that when Jimmy Carter, the pacifist, was out of there and Ronald Reagan took over as chief executive, that they were going to get blown back to the Stone Age, which they really kind of are.
Yeah. Well, yes, yes. And I agree with you on that. And by the way, you make me feel old. You were in nursery school back in 79?
I was in nursery school when that happened. And I remember, I remember watching the news, and I remember, remember Bob Schaefer, I remember was the anchor. It's kind of funny that just 3 years ago, you know, I'm watching Bob Schaefer as a, you know, as a kid, as the anchor of CBS News. And then just 3 years ago, I'm sitting next to, kind of funny that we talk about gummy bears. I'm sitting next to Bob Schaefer at the St. Anselm College Democrat debate, sharing a bag of gummy bears with Bob Schaefer, you know, talking politics. It's just kind of, it's kind of surreal to think about that. But, you know, I remember the images coming across the screen and to a 5 or 6 year old kid who, you know, basically the world ends where my street sign, you know, where the stop sign at the end of my street ends. That's pretty much the end of my world. To see these people, you know, this large group of people that, you know, have this American flag burning and they're chanting death to America, death to America. That's terrifying to a young kid. I remember asking my mom, I said, you know, why do these people hate us? Why do they want to hurt us? And, you know, that's my first memory, you know, so of this, but you know, this is for as long as I can basically remember, as long as I've been alive, that this has been an issue. And think about the acts of aggression that Iran has committed, not only against the United States, but against our allies.
And then
ask yourself,
and by proxy too. I just want to say, remember, Hezbollah is funded by the Iranians. Hezbollah, which is the number one terrorist organization on the planet, is funded by Iranians. But okay, go ahead. Yes.
Well, plausible deniability is a beautiful thing. When you can launch your attacks by proxy, and then when people come back to you and say, "Are you responsible?" "Oh, we have no knowledge of this." No, it's plausible deniability.
And Benghazi, for example. I wrote extensively about Benghazi when it happened, contemporaneous to the events of Benghazi. It wasn't an embassy, it wasn't a consulate, it was a CIA operations headquarters in Libya that was shipping arms and trained individuals up to Turkey, Jordan, and in that area for the ultimate destination in Syria. But Iran, that whole debacle, or the whole attack in Benghazi, was by proxy, by Iranian proxy. And let me just toss this one little piece of information. Folks, if you want to understand what happened in Benghazi, you've got to understand the several, I think it was a 7-person or 7-man contingent of the, Iranian, comparative to the Red Cross, Iranian Red Crescent. The Iranian Red Crescent was doing surveillance on that Benghazi operation. They fired, they lobbed a rocket, hit a wall, and shortly thereafter, that contingent of Iranians, the Iranian Red Crescent, got disappeared. And it was a week or two after Benghazi, after all the smoke cleared, that they reappeared on a street somewhere down on the other side of Benghazi, unharmed. But they were Iranians. It was an Iranian attack by proxy, by terrorist proxy. I just want to throw that in there because a lot of people are misrepresenting, or at least they don't know the entire facts about Benghazi. But go ahead, sir.
No, so you know, it's interesting you bring up Benghazi, because what was the official response from the Obama administration when that occurred? Absolutely nothing.
Right.
But when the American embassy in Iraq gets attacked, what's the American response under President Donald Trump? It's clear and decisive. And listen, if you're going to strike one of our interests, we're going to take care of you. You know, and I don't mean take care of you in a nice way. We're not going to give you a playful pat on the ass and send you on your way. No, we're going to do exactly what we did, which is blow you to hell.
Yeah, we're not playing defense anymore. And I'm glad. I'm tired of playing defense. Look, this might not be, arguably, this might not be is this the hill, you know, to die on, so to speak, in large quotation marks, given the fact that our involvement in the Middle East, just so people know, since 2003, we're down about 60,000 enlisted Navy men, okay? We've neglected the Navy and Air Force. I think somewhere between 2007 and 2012, we've had 500 tactical aircraft retired because of use fatigue over in Iraq and throughout the Middle East. And just a boatload of other ships and other assets that we haven't replaced yet. So we are down right now. Even the B-2 bomber, by the way, the B-2 bomber fleet is only at 10 to 15% readiness because they were overused in Iraq and then throughout the Middle East by the United States. So God forbid that we have a war today with China or Russia. I'm just saying. So anyway.
Well, it's interesting. When we wrapped up the show yesterday talking about the article that came out, wherein China, saying that the Second Amendment needs to basically go the way of the dinosaur. I'm just trying to pull that article up here because I want to quote it exactly. China wants private ownership of guns, bans are severely restricted in the USA. I would be willing to submit to you that, that the reason why they want that is because it would certainly be a lot easier for them to actually try to actually invade, physically invade, if there wasn't that proverbial rifle behind every blade of grass. It would be pretty foolish for any foreign entity to try to invade mainland United States. I mean, you know, certainly our interest outside, I mean, go after Guam or, you know, go after Hawaii or something like that. But mainstream United States, that would be a different story.
Absolutely.
You know, any government entity that tried to invade forcefully the United States of America, I don't think it would last very long, because that's when you would see the true power of the Second Amendment.
Absolutely.
And anybody who questions the number of firearms that are in private hands as opposed to the number of firearms, it has been estimated that there are more firearms in the state of Michigan alone than there are in the entire arsenal. I'm talking small arms. But, obviously more small arms in the state of Michigan alone than there is in the entire military armory. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard combined.
And thank God for that. Yes.
I agree, because in this uncertain time where power is everything and control is everything, the one thing remains pretty clear. It's been a long time since mainland America, mainland United States, has ever seen, you know, foreign hostile forces on our soil. And it would be a big mistake for anybody to do that. I don't know if you remember the movie that came out in 1984, Red Dawn.
Oh, yeah.
Great movie. But something like that, I don't see ever being possible. I mean, the resistance alone would be mind-boggling.
Yeah, and that kind of dovetails a little bit, or segues, or overlaps, I guess is a better term, with what we talked about with Virginia. Look, you know, we are a well-armed population. And when you have, just digressing briefly here, when you've got a state or a commonwealth government deciding, hey, we're gonna quit this. We're gonna take away, ultimately confiscate your guns. I don't care what people say. It's a gun confiscation objective and schedule. So, you know, number one, I question their sanity. I question, obviously, their motives. You know, what's the motive behind this? It's certainly not for guns, or it's not for public safety. This is not a public safety issue. And, really, whose side are you on? And yeah, look at the true reason for the Second Amendment. It's not about hunting. It's not about anything except for, defense against a tyrannical government and foreign invasion. So that's my view anyway. That's my take. So yeah, I mean, it kind of all connects in a way if you squint, I guess, you know.
No, I absolutely agree. And, you know, going back to the follow-up conversations that I had with several people yesterday, after yesterday's show, not as a result of yesterday's show, but just by happenstance that the conversation occurred on the same day, there are so many people that are watching what's happening in Virginia right now and saying this is a huge, huge test, whether or not this is by design, whether or not this was manufactured. And when I say by design, it was, okay, let's actually do this and see what the response is. Let's test the mettle of these people who claim that, you know, oh, the Second Amendment is everything and you can have my firearm when you pry it from my cold, dead hands. You know, again, going back to what we talked about in terms of getting a fair weather Christian versus a true devout Christian to violate the tenets of their faith, same exact thing. You know, would you take the name of Christ to your deathbed? Or would you renounce him to save your own life? Well, the same thing with the Second Amendment. Would you lay your arms down to save your life, or would you truly, truly say, listen, if you want my gun, come and get it. I'm prepared to die. And if you want it, you can take it from me once you've literally taken me out of the equation. It's the same thing. People talk a big game, but there's a big difference between talking and actually doing it. Well, I think a lot of people, a lot of people, I think their mouths write checks that they're not prepared to cash ever.
I agree.
Is, but I think there's a lot of people out there that kind of, well, I like to talk tough, you know, when I can impress my friends when we're sitting around throwing back beers at the barbecue. But when push comes to shove, would you actually do that?
I totally agree with you. And I would, I think, sadly, I think we're going to have that opportunity to see, sooner rather than later. I don't know if Virginia's going to be the flashpoint. I don't know how that's going to turn out. Look, I just don't know. But with respect to your previous question, I'll just say this, you know, about taking, violating your tenets of Christian faith. Eternity is a long time. And, you know, we're here a very short period of time. So if you truly understand and are a believer, then I don't think anything earthly could ever sway a true Christian, true believer into abandoning that. And second of all, slavery is just slightly longer than eternity. At least it feels that way. Yeah, that's my view. So,
but when you're a secular humanist, and this is the problem, when you're a secular humanist, and look at the parallels between what you're talking about right now, and also in terms of the doctrine, the fundamentalist Islamic doctrine of the Islamic State of Iran. Okay. If you're a secular humanist and you don't believe in God, if you don't believe in an afterlife, if you don't believe in a creator, if you don't believe in a higher power, if you believe that we are the highest order on the planet and certainly in the universe, then, you know, okay, it's impossible for me to argue my doctrine against that doctrine because it's something you simply don't believe in. Similarly, under strict fundamentalist Islamic doctrine, if the state of Iran believes that they are acting in a holy and anointed fashion, there isn't a single thing that you can do, including sanctions, that's going to rationalize with them, that's going to cause them to see anything beyond this is something that is ordained by our higher power, our creator, our God, our Allah. And so how do you argue that point? You know, I'm not going to switch. I'm not going to get a secular humanist to turn around and change their behavior by telling them, well, you know, if you do something wrong, you're going to be judged after you die and you're going to spend eternity in a place you don't want to be. They're going to be like, dude, that doesn't exist. I don't believe in it.
Correct.
So would that affect me? Okay. Now, you know what? I wouldn't want to gamble my future on that. I believe in an afterlife. I believe in Christ. I'm a born again Christian. I gave my heart and my life to Christ, and I'm quite content in that decision. I would not want to go against that because you know what? I wouldn't want to roll the dice on the off chance that I'm wrong. Because
or,
you're right.
Or on the off chance you're right. Yeah. I get that. Yes. And I think that speaks to our demographic. I mean, the majority of people who listen to this program are conservative Christians. So I think that they can relate to that, everything you said. But where the disconnect exists, I think you nailed it, is understanding the Islamic theocracy of Iran, of the Middle East states. And people are underestimating that resolve or their resolve. I think we have to really kind of take that into account, especially when we've got such a schizophrenic, by the way, in my view, take on the Middle East and our involvement in Iraq. Donald Trump earlier today was talking about some level of de-escalation and pulling back a little bit. And I think that telegraphing that is not a sign of weakness, but a sign of what we need to do. I don't know if you caught all or part of his news conference, press conference, but there were some indications, some suggestions that we're going to kind of temper things. You know, we're not going to give up, obviously, but we're not going to cause anything to escalate because it just doesn't make any sense, especially when you consider that we've been and are protecting a Baghdadi-based government in Iraq. And what are we really protecting over there in Iraq? Kwanzaa huts and paper mache barriers in essence in Iraq now, not Afghanistan, but Iraq. That's what we're protecting.
And well, if I can hold on, let me get my taper helmet out here. I'm putting it on. Because I'm out of tinfoil. One of the things that I've talked to you about before, and one of the things that I've maintained, I'm not big into conspiracy theories, and I generally don't get into them. But one of the things that I find very interesting is during the first wave of the Americans being in Iraq, one of the first things that they started, well, do you remember what they were finding? Do you remember what soldiers were finding in Saddam's palaces in record numbers? I shouldn't say in record numbers, but in mass quantity.
Well, I mean, artifacts, but go on.
Yeah, but there was something else, too, that they found.
Gold?
Billions of dollars in American currency.
Well, okay.
Wrapped on pallets as if it were ready to be shipped out. Now, there are a number of people that I have interfaced with directly in the intelligence communities who maintain – and this is not an official standpoint, but this is what they maintain and believe. They maintain and believe that the initial invasion of Iraq was designed to prevent Saddam Hussein from dumping American dollars out of reserve and switching over to a euro for their medium of – not for their medium of exchange, but for their reserve currency in preparation to get OPEC to drop the American dollar as the currency through or by which all transactions are settled. OPEC still uses the American dollar, believe it or not, despite the fact that, you know, the West, we're a bunch of infidels and we're horrible and we're awful and, you know, we're antithetical to the tenets of anything that even comes close to resembling Islam. But they still, OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, still settles all of its transactions in American dollars. And one of the big concerns was that OPEC, founded in 1958, was founded in Baghdad. And although Iraq is simply one of the member nations of OPEC, OPEC has largely followed Iraq's lead in terms of the direction to take the organization. They possess a tremendous amount of clout within the OPEC organization. And so the concern was that Hussein was going to dump the American dollar, not only out of reserve, giving the Iraqi dinar its value, but also then trying to get the OPEC and the member nations of OPEC to drop the American dollar out of reserve, switch over to the euro, because Saddam Hussein knew he was never going to be able to, ever going to be able to launch a war, a traditional battle war against the United States. But he had the ability to do severe damage economically. And the spillover effect, if OPEC started to settle its transactions not in American dollars but in euros or any other currencies, it would significantly devalue the American currency, which would result in a subsequent collapse of our bond market, our stock market, and our foreign exchange markets.
Well, you know, you referenced the tinfoil hat. Look, I'm not so sure any of this is of a conspiratorial nature. Look at the Project for the New American Century, the PNAC document or the PNAC doctrine. That was formulated some 23 years ago, 1997. Crystal and, Kagan founded that PNAC document. And that document listed, I think about 9 countries that were in the sights of American regime change for that very reason, monetary reasons or for monetary control reasons. That's, you know, it's not conspiracy theory. It's fact. I mean, it's documented, but okay. And Iran, Iraq, North Korea, Cuba. I'm trying to think of who else is part of this, but anyway, 9 countries back then. So anyway,
how many of those countries are member nations?
I didn't hear that. You wigged out there for a minute.
How many of those nations are members of OPEC as well? Just out of curiosity.
Boy, I don't know. I'd have to look at the report. It's been a long time since I looked at this report. Let me see here. I don't know. Can't answer that without dead air. I can't answer that for you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going through this. It's a pretty lengthy document.
Do you know the names of the countries?
I can give you everything else. The signatories,
if you happen to find it at some point in time.
Yeah.
I'd be curious to see what.
I'm embarrassed now because I should know this from memory. I've had this document on my desk for 10 years or, you know, am I ready for 10 years? I don't though. But every one of the countries that we are at war with or started, war with, we're not using the, we're not using the American monetary system or the monetary system. Help me out with this. Oh my goodness. Help me out with this. I'm going to get all kinds of emails from our listeners saying, what are you nuts? Or, you know, what happened to your mind? My apologies. Again, it's been a while.
Well, when you get to be your age, Doug, I mean, it's the first thing that goes.
So, hey, you know what? Let me watch reruns of Murder, She Wrote and give me some oatmeal and fix my blanket. Locke.
Hey, I think Matlock is on, and actually, you know, it's never too late to start a love romance with the Hallmark Channel.
There you go. There you go.
And all that great programming. No, you know, it's interesting when you, and we could segue into a fascinating conversation about reserve currencies. But, you know, I mean, it's funny when you start talking about it, when we did away with the gold standard and now we have, you know, we talk about the full faith and credit of the American government as what gives our money back, and more to the point, it's the full faith and credit of other countries that hold our dollars in reserve. It's the only reason that our dollar has any value is because other nations see value in the strength of our economy and see value in our money and say, okay, you know, we will hold your dollars in reserve to give our money value, you know, just as you used to hold gold in reserve to give your dollars value.
Well, what really, in my view, the only thing that props up the fiat dollar that we have, the American dollar, it's not gold anymore. You said that went off in 73. And by the way, more people complained about Nixon's announcement interrupting Bonanza on a Sunday night than they did about the actual message that should tell people volumes. But the only thing backing the U.S. dollar right now is not just oil, but the free flow of oil across the globe. That's what's backing the U.S. dollar, in my view. Do you agree with that or no?
Well, I think in part, I think the fact that, you know, that certainly OPEC settles its transactions, OPEC just, and I'm just using it as an example, that there are international consortiums that conduct the settling of their transactions in our currency.
Right.
And the fact that other nations hold our currency in reserve to give their currency, which is probably fiat as well, to give their currencies value as well. I mean, I give you a piece of paper that says, you know, it's like a coupon for a free cheeseburger.
Yeah.
Okay. I give you a piece of paper that is 2 inches by 4 inches square. Does it have any value to you whatsoever?
Well, no, not no. Unless.
But now, if there's something on there that says you can exchange this piece of paper for a free bison burger at Joe's Burger Shack. Okay. Now, does that piece of paper have value?
Only between the holder and the person or the entity that, if it's a bison burger, then in fact, from Bob's Bison Burgers, then it has own value between the holder and Bob's Bison Burgers. That's it.
What if I buy a king size mattress and box set and I call you up and I say, hey, Doug, listen, I need a hand, moving this. If you do, I'll buy you lunch.
You better find someone else, but go on.
You're right, but you see my point. The point is that because that piece of paper can be exchanged for something else, there is some type of inherent value behind that. So there is faith that Bob's Burger Shack is going to give me a burger when I exchange this piece of paper. Otherwise, that piece of paper, I mean, unless I'm just looking for a piece of scrap paper to write a phone number down, really to me is absolutely inconsequential and worthless.
But really, it's the ignorance, and I'm sorry, but it's the ignorance of individuals more than the faith in the paper that provides the value of that paper, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying, because really, if it's not backed by silver if it's not backed by the part of the gold standard. And it's tenuously backed by the promise of free flow of oil or oil. If it's a petrodollar, loosely stated, then, wow, you know, are we, I mean, if you were a rationally thinking person, not familiar with the monetary system of any country, if you were from Mars and you came to this planet, would that set well with you? You know, I don't think it would. But anyway, I'm going off on a tangent here, but what I'm saying is I just don't think that the dollar has any value besides the, what's propped up by the ignorance of the people, as well as, minimal value of the petro standard that we've, you know, that we have. So that's just my view, but you know, I do believe, I believe that all these wars, all wars are bankers' wars. Do you agree with that? I mean, because who, look at the stock market. What stocks went up yesterday or the day before yesterday? What stocks went up? Halliburton, what's the other one?
All of them. You've got General Dynamics, Raytheon, BAE Systems. You've got, all these government contractors and defense contractors. I mean, listen, I mean, there's money to be made. There's money to be made in wars. And so, you know, certainly it's a, what is it? Is it the Rothschild family that supposedly made money by, you know, if you've got party A and party B that are going to war, well, the Rothschilds are going to provide money and loans to party A and to party B. And no matter who wins or loses, they win because, you know, they're making money off the deal. There's money to be made in war. There's no question about it.
Yeah. I think that's true. Obviously.
Is that the driving factor though? Is that the driving force? People certainly worship money as a god, Doug. So, I mean, you could say that it's a religious war. Well, I mean, I guess you could say all war then would be religious, whether it's the driving force behind that war, the motivator behind that war is either religious ideology or political ideology that is in some way, shape, or form formed and shaped by religious ideology, or the desire to enrich oneself, which is the worship of money, which is basically having money as your god.
You
want to put it in the truest sense of the term, all wars are religious wars.
Yeah.
Or money wars.
Yeah, it just depends on which small g or what small g god you're worshiping or they are worshiping. I get that. So, all right. But here we are today in this, the left, how they're reacting to this. That bothers me too. I mean, it bothers the heck out of me. How dare Pelosi and these other people call Donald Trump seditious? How dare they invoke the War Powers Act and every other crazy thing that they never held any other president to before? So I'm just saying, I think it's just ridiculous.
Well, we've said before on this program, you and I have talked about it before, that in the eyes of the progressive leftist, Donald Trump is not a legitimate president. So therefore, anything that he does, anything that comes out of the White House or the Oval Office is an illegitimate act. It is something to be questioned. It's something to be challenged. It's something to be overturned because it's an invalid act coming from an invalid president in their eyes.
That's right. Yeah. That to me is I don't know how we can continue to exist in this fashion, in this framework, in this form, by having people like Pelosi and others, you know, just to me, this is, I don't know, is sedition too bad of a word or too big of a word? Seditious, treasonous? I mean, what would you call their behavior?
Seditious and treasonous.
Okay. Yeah.
Seditious and treasonous. And, you know, it's interesting. There was a ticker that was running across Fox News last night. It was about 11 o'clock. The bottom banner ticker on the screen was that the left-wing media serving as the propaganda arm for Iran. And I have to be honest, it's absolutely correct. You know, it's interesting when you look at Ricky Gervais's performance with the Golden Globes. He roasted those people, and those people not too happy. But, you know, he brought up an excellent point, which is you people are in no position to be lecturing the American people. So let me just give you a couple of highlights here from some of the Hollywood elite. Okay, the actor Don Cheadle, he's got to go. referring to Donald Trump. George Takei.
My favorite.
In response to CNBC. CNBC tweeted out, America just took the world's number one bad guy out. George Takei said, actually, that won't happen until November 2020 by way of our election. Rosie O'Donnell, evidently this lardvark is still out there lumbering around. Off to war. God help us. Hashtag remove Trump.
Lardvark. I need a definition. Lardvark. I'm calling for a definition on lardvark. What is that?
Lardvark, a disgusting, corpulent fat pig.
Okay. Go on, sir.
Okay. Let's see. John Leguizamo, in response to another tweet, Richard Engel writes, Iranians will consider U.S. killing Soleimani as an act of war. A proxy war could erupt, likely in Iraq, but also a danger in Lebanon and Israel. This is a big escalation. John Leguizamo, of course, the political commentator and scholar. This is what Putin wants, chaos in the world. Trump is his puppet, but this helps forget about his impeachment. Let's see. We've got, Stephen King. Okay. In addition to writing some pretty crappy horror novels, Stephen King is a political scholar, as a matter of fact. It's a war about politics, shameful and dangerous. Barbara Streisand, oh yes, Yentl herself, quote, Trump overturned the Iran nuclear deal, which had stopped their weapons program. His policies are only to overturn Obama's progress. We will not be safer from Trump's hasty action in Iraq. Yes, because shipping $1.8 billion in cash to a rogue regime and allowing them to have access to the technology to develop nuclear weapons, this is exactly how we keep the world safe. Barbara, go back to writing songs. Remember the way we were. Patricia Arquette, I will tell you this, with Trump starting a war with Iran, deploying thousands of our troops and putting infrastructure. I can't even read any more of this, Doug. These people need to shut the hell up, go back to writing your music or pretending to be somebody else on the big screen, but stay the hell out of this. And why the fact that these people are even given a forum is beyond me.
Well, I think Ricky Gervais said it very well in this 7-minute, 49-second clip. You know, shut up. Just get your award and go away.
Shut up. Nobody cares. Yeah. I would be willing to bet you half of these people wouldn't even be able to find Iran on a map.
Well, interesting you say that. 3 of 10 registered voters, I saw this today, 3 of 10 registered voters cannot locate Iran on a map. 3 of 10. Wow. Registered voters, no less.
But you're going to tell me why Donald Trump is an idiot for having launched an attack against one of the individuals singularly most responsible for acts of aggression coming out of the Iranian Islamic Republic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, please share with me via your vast amounts. Let's start off. You can qualify your ability to opine on this when you can tell me what the roots are of the issues between Saudi Arabia and Iran. If you can tell me that, then we can have an interesting conversation. Until then, shut up, because I really don't care about your opinion.
Well, especially coming
from somebody like Rosie O'Donnell.
Oh my gosh, yes. And I think most of them drive Subarus with the coexist bumper stickers on the back. And, you know,
By the way, when you look at the coexist bumper sticker, one of the letters is comprised of the co-joining of the male and the female symbol, which even in the coexist, they're acknowledging that there's only two genders. So.
Oh, interesting point.
Yeah, yeah.
Gonna have to point that out.
Yeah. Huh. So there are not 52 genders, according, you know, like what Facebook believes. But anyway, no, it's, you know, this is the totality of everything that is going on right now. I think it comes down to ultimately what you had opened the show talking about, which is the ability of people to stand up and to make a decisive stand and say enough, whether that's the United States now finally putting an end to the acts of aggression by Iran. Putting an end to the acts of aggression by North Korea, or by the citizens of the state of Virginia putting an end to the tyrannical overreach and the acts of aggression, dare I say it, by a liberal, progressive state government.
Look, like the bully you fought, I really believe.
Oh, I didn't fight him. I knocked his ass out. It wasn't a fight. It was him jumping on my back, me taking a swing and knocking his ass out. It was not a fight. it was him getting demolished.
And my bad. And thank you. And I would
just
bet.
To clarify.
Yeah. And a very important distinction too. I would bet that we would see less and less attacks, preemptive attacks or, unprovoked attacks once we respond like this, as opposed to the doctrine of appeasement under the 8 years of Obama and the years before and, Carter before that. And, arguably every president in between. I don't think the world diplomatic corps has seen anything like Donald Trump. And I don't think they know how to react. So I think that this makes them uncomfortable. And it's always good to leave your enemies a little bit, off kilter. And I think that's what Donald Trump is doing.
Mm-hmm.
So
no, and it's I think it's a good start, but I think there needs to be more.
Yeah,
I mean at this point, this has been going on since 1979. Let's put an end to this. Period.
Yeah.
Here's what you do. In my opinion, this is what I think should be done.
Good.
What you do is you simply make a statement. In 48 hours, we are going to launch an unprecedented attack against the Islamic Republic of Iran. So women and children, get the hell out. Give everybody an opportunity. Here's your chance. In 48 hours, we're about to rain hellfire on you. So get out. Now, if the country doesn't want to permit its citizens to leave, that's on them. It's not on us. We gave you ample warning, 48 hours. We don't tell you where we're going to attack. We don't tell you what key sites we're going to attack. Obviously, we're not going to be going after schools and residential areas and hospitals, but you go after the key infrastructure. But you launch an unparalleled, unprecedented carpet bombing campaign against that country.
Boy, you're going to get some feedback on that, I would imagine.
I'm sure I will.
Hmm.
48 hours. Get your women and your children out. You got the warning. Now, I mean, again, if the nation if the Islamic Republic of Iran does not want to allow its people to leave, well, that's not on us. That's on them. We did our due diligence, which is we told you what's coming. It's up to you. But this has got to end. This has been going on now for what, 42 years?
A long time.
Enough is enough. It's over 40 years, the bottom line. Enough is enough.
Yeah, I agree. It's 41 if you count 79, or if you're looking at 1979. It'll be 41 years this February, actually. People think November because of the embassy, but it's February. Go ahead.
What's interesting is that when you look at the sites that were targeted by Iran, they were largely vacant. I mean, that was a surgical strike to ensure that no American citizens were killed. Because again, this is Iran knowing exactly how far they can push things without actually generating that response.
Okay. I was going to ask you about that because there was very limited damage or no casualties, limited damage. Was that was that intentional on their part? Was that just bad equipment, or was that maybe something else going on where we were able to, I don't know, knock some missiles out or push some out, whatever the terminology would be, to redirect the missiles. Do we have that technology? I mean, what is that? What I hear you saying is, we're just going to make a statement as opposed to really doing anything.
Yeah. Well, I think first of all, you had what, 4 missiles that failed. I mean, they just fizzled out and died. So, I mean, that's a failure of their technology.
Right.
I mean, they don't have the technological capabilities. I don't know. I'm not an analyst, so I don't know exactly what their capabilities are or are not. But, I think it's just bad technology on their part.
Okay.
That those missiles failed. Where those missiles were sent, I believe. And this is just my opinion. I'm just saying, had they actually killed, because Trump had said if American service members are injured or killed, that's going to be, that's the line in the sand.
And they fell short.
I think if Iran were truly, truly interested, I mean, they saber rattle all the time. Oh, the United States is going to feel the full wrath and fury, and they hoist up their little red flag and all that stuff. And it's like, oh, that's cute. Guess what? Have you seen the flag of the Marine Corps of the United States? That's red too. So you want to hoist your little red flag over your mosque? Okay, that's cute. We have one too. It's called the flag of the U.S. Marine Corps. That's the first wave of people that are going to rain hellfire and death on your political leaders. But I think that if they really, really wanted to, escalate this, then they would have actually targeted people. They would have targeted our interests over there, and there would have been American casualties. But they were able to do what they did. They were able to say, yes, you know, we attacked the United States, or we attacked the interests of the United States. But by and large, they did it with relative assurance, barring some freak incident where something unexpected occurred, that they were pretty much going to come out unscathed on this.
Okay.
And again, to go back to the sanctions, do they care about sanctions? Who cares about sanctions? They don't care about sanctions.
No.
Because they're always going to, just like North Korea. North Korea is going to find some nation that will continue to do business with them, partially because it's in their economic best interest to do so, and number two, because it's kind of an act of defiance against the United States.
Exactly. Yeah. I totally agree with you. I don't think sanctions work that much. I mean, no, sanctions are not effective. And I think that I agree. And they don't care about
sanctions. Are like me saying to my bully, okay, if you continue to do this, I'm not going to invite you to my birthday party.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's, I'm going to sit at home and cry myself to sleep on my Captain America pillow.
Yeah. You're banned from my house.
It's not going to matter.
All right.
You got to get them where it counts. You got to speak the language that they understand, which is force. And again, I would challenge anybody to look at any instance where a criminal, a bully, a thug, or a tyrant has respected anything other than sheer and brute force. People respect the Second Amendment in this country. Your listeners respect the Second Amendment in this country. Why do people carry guns for personal protection? Because getting down on your knees and pleading for your life has absolutely no relevance or bearing on a person who is hell-bent on taking it.
Amen.
The only thing that person will understand is sheer force. Your ability to meet their force with equal force or greater force and stop them from their aggressive, deadly behavior.
Agreed.
And it's the same thing with Iran. They are engaged in a pattern of aggressive and deadly behavior. The only thing that they will understand and respect, the only thing that will curb or curtail their behavior, is force equal to or greater than that which they themselves are capable of expending.
I totally agree with you on that. And you know, Iran, by the way, should not have the nuclear capabilities. Now that this is a point of argument and contention, but they should not have the nuclear capabilities that they have right now. And this is all compliments of our own government specifically Obama, but this goes back to, Pakistan and back in the, Bush era, in Clinton and Bush era, but nonetheless. They need to be stopped. And I agree 100% with you. By the way, we only have about, 14 minutes left of the show. I do want to mention to the audience that, the Keith Hansen Show, powered by the Hagman Report, is coming up, an hour of commentary. Oh my gosh. I can't wait. It's going to be starting next week. Keith, I can't wait to hear your show. I can't wait, because you have so much to offer, so much information to offer. And this is just the beginning, folks. This is just the beginning.
We have got some, and I will tell you this, we have got some fantastic things that are cooking. You and I have been working diligently behind the scenes here to put together some pretty amazing things. And there is going to be a wave of Christian conservative media and programming coming out here in the next, you know, over the next couple of months and going into the end of this year and into next year, I think is going to be a real game changer.
And I think now is the time, because of all things, today the Wall Street Journal opinion piece, I don't know whether you saw this or not, came out. The headline is, "Be Prepared for President Sanders." The subheadline is, "The Vermont Socialist could soon become the front runner for the Democratic nomination." Doesn't give me the warm fuzzies as a headline in the Wall Street Journal. I mean, really, but see, now is a good time for your program and for us to really dig in. And I believe we are part of, we have skin in this game and we're part of the fight. We're an integral part of the fight, I believe. So important part of the fight as well. So,
you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because there's a lot of people that have been looking at Bernie Sanders. And, you know, there was a really interesting piece in Politico. I should email you this and have you put it up on the link so people can connect to this. I'm pulling the article up because I want to get the date of this. It was December 26th. 2020. People want to check this out. Just Google political. Bernie could win the Politico. Excuse me. Bernie could win the nomination. His resiliency in the primaries caught the attention of the party establishment. For months, the Vermont senator was written off by Democrat Party insiders as a candidate with a committed but narrow base who was too far left to win the primary. Elizabeth Warren had skyrocketed in the polls and seems to be leaving him behind in the race to be progressive voters' standard bearer in 2020. But in the past few weeks, something has changed. In private conversations and on social media, Democratic officials, political operatives, and pundits are reconsidering Sanders' chances. And one of the biggest reasons is because he is exceptionally resilient. And what you'll notice is that none of the other candidates attack Bernie. They'll attack each other, but they don't go after Bernie. And so it's one of two things. Either Bernie's message, according to or in the eyes of the progressives, can't be beat. I mean, I think the average person listening to this program right now could defeat Bernie Sanders and his political and economic theories. But you know, you'll notice that not a lot of candidates go after him.
No, until you said that, I really didn't think that much about it. But you're right. I don't remember.
David Brock, a longtime Hillary Clinton ally who founded a pro-Clinton super PAC in 2016, said, quote, "It may have been inevitable that eventually you would have two candidates representing each side of the ideological divide in the party. A lot of smart people I've talked to lately think there's a very good chance those two end up being Biden and Sanders. They're both proving to be very resilient." Democratic insiders say they're rethinking Sanders' bid for a few reasons. First, Warren has recently fallen in national. She's done. She peaked too early. There's no question about it. Dan Pfeiffer, who served as an advisor to former President Barack Obama, said, quote, "I believe people should take him very seriously. He has a very good shot of winning Iowa, a very good shot of winning New Hampshire, and other than Joe Biden, the best shot of winning Nevada. He could build a real head of steam heading into South Carolina in Super Tuesday." Now, the only thing that I could think would really be an issue here, and this is, you know, in talking with some Democrats who I there are actually a few Democrats out there that I do have intelligent conversations with. One of the concerns that they have with Sanders, or I shouldn't say the concerns, one of the things that assuages their concerns about Sanders is that they don't see the DNC ever allowing a person to gain the nomination who technically isn't a part of their party. Remember, Bernie is not a Democrat. Bernie will caucus with the Democrats.
Right. He's an independent.
But he's an independent. He's not a Democrat.
Right.
And so, you know, would the, which, I mean, the, you think about it. Most people look at Bernie Sanders and say, well, he's an absolute parasite. You know, he's a freeloading couch surfer who's done nothing in his life, who literally sucks off the teat of government. He's a perfect parasite. And he's parasitic in his political approaches as well, too. So he utilizes the strength and the momentum and the steam of a political party that he attaches himself to, but that he's not a part of. He's a true parasite.
Man, they all are parasites, though. But he's the king parasite, I suppose, of the political party, or at least the parasitic face of the political party. I don't know. I mean, oh my goodness.
Well, I'd be careful not to be too quick to perch a crown on that chrome dome, because I think that's exactly what he wants. I don't think that he wouldn't look at the inauguration as being the inauguration. It would be as a coronation, which I think the vast majority of these people do. I mean, certainly Hillary would look at that as her coronation.
You know,
there hasn't been a Freudian slip where she's referred to it as a coronation.
I'm telling you, man, I still have my feelings about Clinton coming out after the debates and, you know, have a contested, convention, in her coming out in a statement of unity. Oh, let's, you know, I've got to come out and I've got to, now that all the hard work's over, I've got to be the face of the party to unify the party and,
No, and I agree with you. That's the one thing that in that article that, I mean, again, that's, I'm simply reading the article. I'm not sharing my opinion. I don't believe that we have seen the end of Clinton. There have been a number of pundits who have come out and said that really the only person who could beat Trump at this point in time would be Clinton. So, listen, anything is possible. And there are no such thing as, when it comes to politics, there are no such thing as coincidences. Everything is planned out. And people wait 4 years, 8 years, 12 years until it's, quote, their time. And so she may be looking at this and saying, you know what, this is, quote, my time. And depending, and I've heard a lot of people that have floated the concept. In fact, I think I mentioned this last week when I was on your show, the concept of a Clinton-Obama ticket.
Yeah. Which just scares the hell out of me. Because look, I listen to my wife a lot.
It's a double home run, though, Doug. I mean,
it is.
You're getting the female vote. You're getting the double female vote, and you're getting the black vote
and the transgender vote.
Exactly. You're truly pandering to a lot of your special interest groups.
That statement is going to get me taken off the air. I know. Yeah, you're right. But you know, I listen to my wife a lot, and she's always right. You know, when it comes to things. When I said, what about a Hillary, nomination or the Hillary ticket? I said, nah, too many people hate her. Do you think that's the case? Do you think, I mean, obviously you got half of America that has a strong dislike. I'm not sure hate is the word. Maybe, but.
I mean, I don't know what percentage of the population, the voting population, actually, you know, dislikes her enough to. I mean, listen, there's not a single thing about Mitt Romney that I liked, but I voted for him because he was the, quote, lesser of two evils. So, I think for a lot of people, you know, listen, they're gonna vote along party lines. Whoever happens to be the nominee, is gonna wind up getting their vote simply because it's the nominee of that ticket.
Yeah, I didn't mean to overtalk you there.
No,
I don't know. The ticket with Michelle on there, it scares me because I just think that, people are so brainwashed into believing this Camelot, the second Camelot under Obama. I don't know, man. I don't know. Anything's possible, even Michelle Obama coming out and, you know, taking the top spot because, yeah, I've got to. I don't want to, but I've got to because, well, we got to unify. We got, you know, for unity purposes. But, man, I don't know. It's going to be an interesting year, I'll say that. Lastly, your thoughts on the Ukraine 737 airliner, flight 752, Tehran to Ukraine went down yesterday. Any thoughts on that? Any shenanigans there or...
I'd be curious to see what the black box has to say, but preliminary reports are right now that Iran is not going to provide the black box to Boeing to extract the data. So, you know, why the cover up?
Yeah.
I mean, and I hate to use the word cover up, but I mean, you know, the flight data recorder that contains crucial information about the last moments of that flight and the events leading up to whatever caused that disaster. And so for them to withhold access to that black box, is akin to covering something up. What is the reason why you don't want that black box being released? Is it because it contains information that forensic analysts would be able to say, yep, okay, what caused this was a missile strike, for instance?
Exactly.
Whatever caused that plane to go down, there's going to be analytics in that black box that are going to be able to point to a cause, whether it was a systems failure, whether it was a pilot error, whether it was something that just occurred out of the blue. And so, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you're unwilling to give over the information that allows the investigators to do their job, you're impeding the investigation. At that point, you have to kind of go, all right, well, what's the motivation for impeding an investigation?
Kind of like a store owner refusing to turn over the surveillance videotapes of a robbery an alleged robbery. Okay. Yeah. I get that.
Or somebody maybe bleach bidding their hard drive.
Oh, yes.
I don't want to speculate.
I love you, brother. I'll tell you what. I'm looking forward to the Keith Hansen show upcoming, starting next week, actually. It's going to be great. I want to say thank you. You're going to be back with me, to close out the week on Friday for an hour. And I just want to say thank you because I know it's an imposition for you I know you make great sacrifices, to be part of this. And I want to say thank you for doing so. But you always add value to the program. Your insight is extremely valuable. People look for it. They depend on it. Now they're going to have you on a regular basis, and we love it. And so I'm going to say
you mind if I bring a friend along on Friday?
You know, I was going to ask you if you don't mind so I can just, you know, not say anything.
I think, and I'm not going to tell you who, I just reached out to him as I was talking to you. I just sent him a text message.
Okay.
I don't know if he's going to be available. I'm not going to mention who it is because I don't want to tease. So that way I'm not a liar if I say he's going to be there on Friday and he's unable to because of his schedule, but let me see what I can do. And,
all right.
Trust me, it'll be, if I can get him to confirm, for Friday, because it is kind of last minute with his schedule, but if I can get him to confirm, it'll be a real special treat for your listeners.
All right. Sounds good. And if Tucker can make it, I'm sorry. I shouldn't say anything like that. All right, brother. I was kidding, folks. I was kidding. And Keith, do you mind if I put your email link in the program description box? If anyone wants to get in touch with you, they can do so.
Yeah, please. No, absolutely.
All right.
Keith on the air at gmail.com. And then, of course, at Real Keith Hansen on Twitter. That's at Real Keith Hansen on Twitter. If you send me a tweet, chances are I'm not going to see it because I really don't spend a lot of time on Twitter. It's just a cesspool of incivility, but.
I love that. Yeah. I love that cesspool of incivility. You're exactly right. That's exactly what it is. Keith, at the end of the program, I want to say thank you, my brother. We will be talking with you. Looking forward to, again, for Friday and as well as next week. Folks, buckle up and make sure your CPACs and tray tables are in their full upright and locked position because Keith Hansen is coming out. wait a second.
Careful about that there. He's painting me into a corner there. So, premiering, launching.
There you go. All right, brother.
God bless. Thanks so much.
All right. Folks, that'll do it for the Hagman Report. My goodness, how quickly the time went. And by the way, I was kidding around with Keith when I said Keith is coming out. He's launching the premiere under powered by Hagman Report. Seriously, it's a good fit, isn't it? It really is. And by the way, we'll work on them in terms of conspiracy theories. No, I mean conspiracy facts. We'll work on one. I will. I'm wearing them down, folks. I'm wearing them down. Actually, he's more open-minded than he lets on. He is. Eric's over there shaking his head. Yep. Before you go, folks, I want to mention HagmanStore.com. That's HagmanStore.com. Folks, Hagman Coffee, Hagman Gourmet Coffee, please support what we do in helping the groups that, and even ourselves, fighting human trafficking and child sex slavery. That's HagmanStore.com. You have a good night, everyone.